And it's a great privilege and a great joy to be back here with you. Despite the fact that it's just another day, the start of a year always seems to carry an extra significance to it. Maybe we're excitedly looking forward to what's ahead, or maybe we're just glad to escape from the last one. Maybe some of us are reflecting backwards with mixed emotions. In many Methodist churches around the world, they use the first Sunday for what they call a covenant Sunday. It's a tradition that goes right back to John Wesley. And he just developed a regular ceremony that would enable people to open themselves and respond to God's call. He called it the covenant service. Just to hear God's offer of fellowship and God's challenge to offer ourselves to him more deeply and to give people an opportunity to respond. Well, I've been thinking over the few months since Stephen asked me about what I would share today. And I just kept finding my mind being drawn back to one thing in particular. And it's a story that goes back over 3,000 years. And it's recorded for us in the Old Testament book of Joshua. And whilst it wasn't a talk that was delivered on New Year's Day or the first Sunday of the New Year, it was just a particular time for reflection and renewal, a kind of covenant ceremony in its day. The Israelites had come to a point where, having fought many battles, they were pretty well settled in the promised land. Joshua, who was their leader, was now very old. And he felt it was an appropriate time to reflect on how far they had come and also set a course for the future. And it's really quite poignant because he knows that he doesn't have much time left with them. So let's pick up the story. It's in Joshua 23. And we'll read bits and pieces from this in the next few minutes. So after a long time had passed and the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them, Joshua, by then a very old man, summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to them, "I am very old. You yourselves have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was the Lord your God who fought for you." And then verse 6. "Be very strong. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, without turning aside to the right or to the left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them. But you are to hold fast to the Lord your God, as you have until now. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you, just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. But if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you." And then, likely the next day, as the story develops, he brings the people to a very significant location, a place called Shechem. In Genesis 12, we read that it was at Shechem where God promised to Abraham to give them this land, and there Abraham built an altar. In Genesis 35, we read of Jacob and all his household burying their foreign gods there, committing themselves to fully following the Lord. In Genesis 37, it's actually the place where Joseph finds his brothers and from where they sold him into slavery in Egypt. And intriguingly, it's also where they would bury Joseph's bones when they brought them back up from Egypt. And in Joshua chapter 8, Shechem was at the foot of Mount Ebal. The people had had great victories over Jericho and Ai, and there at Shechem they built an altar to God. They made stone copies of the law, And half of the people stood on Mount Ebal, and half of them stood on Mount Gerizim, opposite it, and they pronounced God's blessings for obedience, and also the curses that were warnings for disobedience. So Joshua had assembled them here at what was a very significant place, dripping with memories. And as he nears his final days, Joshua wants to remind the people of God of what God has done for them, and also what God calls them to be as they go into the future. So he invites them to renew the covenant that they had made with God. So let's read on in chapter 24. Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem. He summoned the elders, leaders, judges, and officials of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said to all the people, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago, your ancestors, including Terah, the father of Abraham and Nahor, lived beyond the Euphrates River and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from the land beyond the Euphrates and led him throughout Canaan and gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. I assigned the hill country of Seir to Esau, but Jacob and his family went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I afflicted the Egyptians by what I did there, and I brought you out. When I brought your people out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Red Sea. But they cried to the Lord for help, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. He brought the sea over them and covered them. You saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. Then you lived in the wilderness for a long time. I brought you to the land of the Amorites who lived east of the Jordan. They fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. I destroyed them from before you, and you took possession of their land. When Balak, son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel, he sent for Balaam, son of Beor, to put a curse on you. But I would not listen to Balaam, so he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of his hand. Then you crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho. The citizens of Jericho fought against you, as did also the Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites, and Jebusites. But I gave them into your hands. I sent the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you, and also the two Amorite kings. You did not do it with your own sword and bow. So I gave you a land on which you did not toil, and cities you did not build, and you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant." It's so moving. You can picture Joshua, the old man, people hanging on his every word. Probably you'd hear a pin drop as they strain in to listen to what their great leader has to say. And one thing you can't fail to notice, as Joshua retells their story, there's a really clear thread. It's that this was God's doing. I took your father Abraham, I led him, I gave him, I assigned, I sent Moses, I brought you out, I did to the Egyptians, I brought you to the land, I gave them into your hand, I destroyed them, I delivered you. It's crystal clear, everything they are is tied up in their relationship with God and what he had done. Yes, they were in covenant, but make no mistake, this was not an equal covenant. Everything they were was down to God. The sovereign King of Kings had been at work on their behalf, and on that basis, he called them into a relationship of surrender to him. Isaiah, it's actually verse 12, I left a digit out. He puts it this way, "Lord, all that we have accomplished, you have done for us." We can never forget that. Everything we are, everything we ever hope to be is down to God being at work in us. And anyhow, having made that totally clear to them, Joshua hits them with the challenge for the future. Because it's all very well to look back and be thankful for what God has done. But the past doesn't guarantee today or tomorrow. It's like a good win for your sports team. It might give you an encouraging foundation on which to build, but you still have to go out and do it again today and again and again. Today is what matters. And so Joshua lays it on the line. Verses 14 and 15. Now, fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your ancestors worshipped beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. I'm sure you know those words. Choose yourselves this day whom you will serve. But even if they're familiar, I just want to encourage all of us to take them to heart at the start of a new year, because they're just as relevant to us today in Green Island as they were to the people back then 3,000 years ago. And there are two words in particular that just jump out at me from what Joshua said. One of them, we love. One of them, not so much. Choose and serve. We love choice. So, I enjoy reading the Times, mainly because I love the cryptic crossword. It's the only thing I have to fend off senility. And every now and again, I read some of the articles as well. Well, I was really grabbed by this one. It said, Christmas is under threat. And I thought, I love Christmas. If it's under threat, I need to know why. So it was under threat because of supply chain difficulties. And as they interviewed different people, this is what one of them said. I mean, this is, it's really bad. Because instead of having 10 types of pasta to choose from this year, we may only have 5. And I thought, seriously? This is Christmas under threat because we've only got 5 types of pasta to choose from instead of 10. I mean, how did we ever get here to define that defines a crisis? Now, I'm not wanting to be flippant about supply chain, because anybody in retail knows the challenges of that. But seriously, calling a crisis because we can only get 5 types of pasta isn't a crisis compared to what the vast majority of people in the world have to cope with. We still have plenty of choice. Well, of course, the choosing that Joshua was referring to is not as unimportant as choosing which type of pasta we're going to cook. It's way more important than that, because it's not just about choosing. It's about choosing to serve. And that's the bit that we don't really like so much. If anything is offensive to our modern society today, it has to be even the very notion of serving somebody else. Because we're obsessed with our freedom and our rights as individuals, our opinions, our desires. Can you just take a minute to try and reflect on how a statement like choose whom you are going to serve comes across in this generation? Does it bear any resemblance at all to any current worldview? I don't think it does. I try to follow what's going on around us in the world. And honestly, at times, I am just at a complete loss to get my head around it. We are really messed up, particularly in the Western world or the global north or whatever term you want to use to describe so-called advanced civilization. So let me just give you one example. On the one hand, we have people protesting vehemently, supporting the right to carry out abortions right up to term. And at the same time, some of those same people telling us that we have damaged them irreparably because we've called them the wrong name, or we've referred to them inappropriately, or we've even mispronounced their name. Or we cancel people for good because of a careless comment they made on Twitter when they were a teenager. Now, please hear me. I'm not trying to simplify complex issues. The whole abortion thing is a really complex issue. And the whole way about how we use language is a complex issue. But the craziness that is driving modern values just shows how society can be jarringly wrong and messed up. How can we treat human life so cheaply on the one hand, and yet become so militant about our words? Some of you probably watched the Harry Potter shows over Christmas. J.K. Rowling, who wrote it, written out of the script because some people didn't like her words. All the people that have made their fortunes on the back of her, but were pushing her to the side because we don't like what she said. It's crazy. And given that for the most part, these issues are debated by people who don't believe in a creator, who think we are all just products of random chance, who say we are just a collection of physical matter with no eternal future, it's all the crazier. Because if all I am is a bunch of regurgitated slime that happened to make itself into this specimen here that stands before you, what does anything matter at all? And why would I get so hot under the collar about the name that somebody calls me? You see where I'm going with this? There's something really messed up about how we think. How do we resolve it? I think some of the answer can be found by looking back. Joshua challenged God's people about buying into the ways of the nations around them, one of which was worshipping idols. You know, lumps of wood that they covered with gold or silver, or maybe just left as wood, or totem poles. I've just been reading through the prophets in the Old Testament, and Isaiah draws attention to it in a scathing way. Like he's saying, it's so obvious how ridiculous it is, to make something out of wood and then bow down and worship it. It's totally ridiculous. We know that that's not wise, the notion that something we have made is worthy of our worship. We do know that's not wise, don't we? No? Do we know that's not wise? Do you? Are you sure? I'm not so sure. Because we mock the idea that people would worship a lump of wood that they've carved into a god. But surely we do exactly the same thing when we live our lives by the ideas we dream up in our own minds. Just because we haven't carved them into a shape and we don't bow down before them, is it really any different? I'm not sure that it is. And I think that's our problem. That's what has brought us to this type of scenario that I've just painted, where being called the wrong name is a greater sin than what we do to an unborn child. And we're seeing all around us the consequences when what one person or group has decided is right clashes with what another person or group decides is right. It's a mess. When we decide for ourselves what is right, when we make a god out of our own thinking, this is the consequence. So what's the answer? Well, the answer sounds a bit contradictory, but I firmly believe the answer is in choosing to serve the God who has revealed himself to us as the great creator and sustainer, but also as the loving father. And not just by serving him, but by actually considering what it means to serve him. Because our problem is we hear a word like serve, and it offends our sense of being in charge of our own destiny. It sounds like slavery. It sounds like denying ourselves what we want. It sounds like oppression. But is it really? Is it really oppression to do things the right way? Let me ask you this. A couple of simple examples. Anybody here drive a petrol car? Has anybody ever put diesel in a petrol car? Oh, Philip Griffiths was able to admit to that earlier in the first service. So what happens when you put diesel in a petrol car? Doesn't end well. Wreck the car. But you're going, I don't care if the manufacturer said only put petrol in this car. That's destroying my freedom. I want to be free to put these on this car, so I'm jolly well going to do it. Well, what happens to your freedom there? Your freedom leaves you in a terrible mess because you didn't run the thing the way the thing was made to run. Get it? And the same happens with humanity. When we don't use it the way the Maker said it should be used, we get into a terrible mess. And freedom isn't really freedom. Let me give you another concrete example. Two of my sons were here earlier. Ben's the eldest one, and I'm using this example with his permission, just in case you're worried. Ben's had a few challenges this past year with work and some other things and furloughs and on and off and other bits and pieces. And we've just been trying to walk our way through some of these challenges. We've had some honest conversations. And one of those involved this realization that we end up being slaves to what we thought was freedom. Take an everyday situation. So you will have noticed that on the roads in the country, most of them have got these round signs with numbers in them. If you live in Green Island, you know all about it. Because it's either that road or that road. They're going to get you one way or the other. We'll not ask for a show of hands. But those things there are not just suggestions. Margaret, stop pointing at other people. He who is without sin, cast the first stone. Anyhow, they're not just suggestions. And sometimes we decide, well, that doesn't apply to me. And in my freedom, I don't want to be restricted by what those things say. Well, do you know what happens when you take that attitude and you develop that habit? Eventually that habit bites you. And points go on your license. And what do points mean? Points mean prizes. Except they're not the kind of prizes that you want. Because your car insurance costs start to change. And not only that, it has a knock on to the kind of car that you want to drive, because you realise that the kind of car you want to drive, you can't afford the insurance, because you've decided that in your freedom, you're not going to follow these rules. And before you know it, your desire to be free has led you to be enslaved to what you thought was freedom. Or let's go beyond that to the regular living of everyday life with its relationships and responsibilities and situations. If you decide you're going to live it all by your own notions or your own desires, and each time something comes up, you're just going to pick whatever suits you best, well, just wait for the trap. So you hit an awkward situation. Do you tell the truth or do you tell a lie? And you hit another awkward situation. Because of that first one. Do you tell another lie? Or do you realise the only way out is the truth? Or when the bill comes in, do you pay it? Or do you not? Or when you get a letter that says you're in a new house and you don't have a TV licence and you need to have one, do you pay for it or not? Do you fill in all the details on the tax form or do you not? Do you tell your insurance company about the said penalty points or do you not? Or do you tell the truth about who the main driver was when it was caught in that camera? Or do you not? Or do you call in sick, but just because you've partied too long and too hard the night before? And I'm only dreaming up, you know, scenarios here. But imagine if your daily life is just an endless one of having to make those decisions all the time in each situation. What road am I going to take? It's a nightmare. But imagine that you've made the choice to trust in a God who has given us a way to live. One who has made us and shown us how to handle situations. One who has promised to live in us and for his power to be at work in us to enable us to keep on making the right choices. And so when it comes to telling the truth or lying, there's no choice to be made. And when there's no choice to be made, you know what? There's no stress. Because you're not trying to work out the implications. Well, what will happen if I tell the truth here? What will happen if I tell a lie here? And you don't have to worry about trying to keep all those plates spinning. And there's no fear of a knock on the door with a summons or of being asked to report to the station with your documents. You get where I'm going with this. Who is really free? Is it the person who has found a good way to live? Or is it the person who is always having to duck and dive, work a move, concoct another story? Now, I need to make this clear. Please don't be thinking Ben had all of those other issues as well. I was only using the first one as an example. But that's the kind of conversation it led us to having. And we started to realize that some people are free and some people are slaves. And the ones who are free are the ones who have chosen to serve. Because the more we rely on our own so-called wisdom, the more entangled we get in the webs that we weave for ourselves. Isaiah uses two great pictures when he writes about this kind of thing. He talks about the crazy idea that an axe can lift itself above the one who holds it. Or one that we're maybe more familiar with. About the clay pot that thinks it can tell the potter what to do. And yet when we turn our backs on God, that's what we're doing. And the end is disastrous. The last few verses of Isaiah 50 paint a great picture. It compares those who walk in God's light with those who light their own fires. And God says they will lie down in torment. But by not going your own way and not doing as you please, you will find your joy in the Lord. I actually did, get this, I did philosophy at university. Who could ever have told now? But there's a great philosopher called Bob Dylan. And he once put it like this. You're going to have to serve somebody. Either we will serve the prevailing wisdom of the day. Or either we will serve what we think we want in each new situation. Or we can choose to serve the Lord who made us. And who not only knows what's best for us, but he also wants what's best for us. But we'll all serve someone or something. Let's not kid ourselves. And we have to choose. And as we finish, let's just think about this word choose. I was intrigued. I looked into it to see how different translations expressed it. And in the Greek translation of the Old Testament that was widely used in Jesus' day, it's translated as a decisive, one-off, right here, right now decision. Make the call, decide once and for all that this is the way you're going. In Hebrew, however, it's actually a slightly different tense. It's expressed in a way that suggests there's still some unfinished business. Well, I like them both. Because there is a time for a decisive decision. A realization that we've been going the wrong way and a total turnaround is needed. The problem with that is Christianity is littered with people who supposedly made a decision once, but whose lives were never changed for good by that decision. And that's why the concept of unfinished business appeals to me. And the need for a daily choosing to follow the Lord. Because in fact, let's be honest, until the day we die, we're going to have that daily need to choose again to follow. Because the temptation to go our own way will confront us all the time. And we need that daily commitment of faith to keep going. And I find it really intriguing that Joshua says this as he nears his death. I mean, he's a really old man. And still after a lifetime of faithfully serving the Lord, he's saying, today again, I'm choosing to serve the Lord. I'm not just going to go through the motions. I'm looking around here. So I had a birthday a couple of days ago. And the truth of the matter now is, I'm closer to 60 than I am to 50. And like a number of us here, there's definitely more of my life behind me than there is in front of me. And maybe as we get older, we can fall too easily into the trap of going through the motions of something called Christianity. Instead of realizing each day the need to surrender to the Lord and to keep on choosing to serve. But this is the great part. Because even if we have wasted years, or even if we've never embraced God's truth, or if we've been careless, there's a constant message through the Bible, and it's this. God reaches out with compassion to those who are prepared to turn to him, however far away they've been, and for however long. Because you see, this isn't just about serving God because he's God, because he's sovereign, because he's the creator, although he is. And it's not just about serving God because it's the best way to live. It's living according to the Maker's instructions, although it's true. And it's not just about serving God to ensure an eternal reward as opposed to eternal separation, although that's true. It's about serving God because of the hugeness of his love. Because the story of his grace is just amazing. And for all the messages of judgment and warnings that the prophets gave, there was always this promise. And Isaiah puts it in words that I just love. The Redeemer will come to those who repent of their sins. Turnaround is possible for those who turn around. Because that's what repent means. For those who choose to serve the Lord. Stop trusting their own so-called wisdom. God promises his future because his love is so great. My favourite verse puts it like this. Oh, not that one. God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. It doesn't get any better than that. And this is the God who calls us to serve him. As I was preparing this and writing it down, the words of an old song by a guy called Don Francisco started to come back to me. And I'm not going to sing them, but this is how they go. I don't care where you've been sleeping. I don't care who's made your bed. I already gave my life to set you free. There's no sin you can imagine that is stronger than my love. And it's all yours. If you'll come home again to me. What better time than at the start of a new year to respond to that love? To choose today and every day to serve this great God, but this loving God. I guess it just boils down to this. If God really is God, then surely the only choice we can make is to serve him and find what true fulfillment and true freedom really means. I'm going to put up on the screen, I talked earlier about the Methodist covenant. I'm going to put the words of that covenant on the screen. I'm going to read them to you. Normally, if you were in Methodist church, I think you'd be preparing for this in advance and you would stand and say it together, but this context doesn't lend itself to that because you shouldn't do this lightly. But I want to read these words for us as we close. And maybe you want to reflect on it. I am no longer my own, but yours. Put me to what you will. Rank me with whom you will. Put me to doing. Put me to suffering. Let me be employed for you or laid aside for you, exalted for you or brought low for you. Let me be full, let me be empty. Let me have all things, let me have nothing. I freely and wholeheartedly yield all things to your pleasure and disposal. And now, glorious and blessed God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you are mine, and I am yours. So be it. And the covenant now made on earth, let it be ratified in heaven.